We're looking at the second of the 7 points in the 7-point mind training, the main practice, the practice of wisdom and compassion. And of course here the wisdom wing, the Vipassana wing, is ultimate bodhicitta, this wisdom of emptiness. So we had a look at that practice, how to practice it in meditation, and how to practice it in daily life in terms of illusory-like emptiness. And then the compassion wing of the practice is the conventional bodhicitta. And in striving to cultivate conventional bodhicitta, we had those two main methods that were taught, the seven cause and effect and the exchanging self with others. So we had a brief look at the seven cause and effect method. That was the most widely taught one. And the one we're looking at here, or the using in the Lojong or mind training practice, is the exchanging self with others. And in that exchanging self with others, we saw in the full process, there are five steps. There is first the equalizing self with others, then reflecting on the disadvantages of self-cherishing, the advantages of cherishing others. And then on that basis, exchanging self with others, and then the meditative practice of Tonglen. And we're currently looking at the meditative practice of Tonglen, giving and taking. So we had a look at the practice, the two aspects of the practice. The first aspect of the taking suffering from others, which is compassion. And then the second part was to give. And giving, and that was of course loving kindness practice. So this practice of mentally taking suffering and giving happiness is a very powerful way of reducing our self-cherishing mind, because the self-cherishing mind, the last thing it would want to do would be to take any suffering from anyone, and the last thing the self-cherishing mind would want to do would be to give away any happiness to anyone. So just mentally wanting to do that is really reducing our self-cherishing, increase the mind of cherishing others. Another way of saying that is it's transforming our attachment and aversion into loving kindness and compassion. And we saw there that we should do this in stages, just as the normal with the loving kindness and compassion practice. First we do it with friends, then out to strangers, to enemy, to all sentient beings. But probably need to add one step at the very beginning, in our modern society, because I think in our modern society we're often suffering from low self-esteem and even self-hatred, not feeling good about ourselves. So therefore we need to start with ourselves, and then we can slowly expand it out to others. And we saw here in page 6 of the text that we are to place the two astride the breath, meaning that it's very helpful to do this Tonglen practice in conjunction with the breath. That on the in-breath we do the compassion work, taking the suffering. On the out-breath we're giving the happiness, the loving-kindness. And by conjoining it with the breath, that helps us to stay focused. And this is what's been mentioned here in the commentary. There was just one more thing I wanted to go back to, also on page 6. In that sort of last paragraph before place the two astride your breath, there was A sentence that started, again, take upon yourself the subtle obscurations to knowledge that exist within the disciples, the self-realized ones, and the noble bodhisattva abiding on the levels. Here, it's talking about three types of practitioner. Previously, we talked about the three vehicles, and the three vehicles were Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. But just to confuse you, these three types of practitioner are also called the three vehicles. But here we're talking about three vehicles as in three types of approach to practice, rather than three levels of practice that we talked about in Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. And so here are the three vehicles or three types of practitioner. The first one is the disciples. And this usually is translated as hearer. And that's a translation of the Sanskrit word shravaka. And shravaka literally means someone who hears or listens to instructions. So someone who really is relying on a teacher, hearing instructions and following those instructions. So that's one approach to practice. And then you have the second one here, which is translated here as self-realized ones. More commonly, it is translated as solitary realizer. The power's out at the moment, so don't worry. We have to go into darkness. So the solitary realizer is a translation of the Sanskrit word Pratyeka Buddha. And this type of practitioner, as the name suggests here, of course they initially need to hear some instructions and receive some instructions, but then they would go off into solitude and complete the path on their own without the need of a teacher. So that's what solitary realizer or Pratyeka Buddha. Pratyeka Buddha means sort of self-realized, awakened one. Someone who really goes into solitude and completes the path on their own without the need of a teacher. So these are two different approaches to practice. And both of these types of a practitioner are striving for the goal of nirvana. They have as their goal nirvana. And then we have the third one here. It says noble bodhisattvas. So the third vehicle is the bodhisattva vehicle. And the bodhisattva is striving for, of course, enlightenment. So sometimes you'll see this presentation of these three vehicles. So just to be aware that we're just talking about three different types of practitioner. The first two striving for the role of nirvana and the bodhisattva striving for enlightenment. So here what it's saying, of course, is that, yes, we can do tonglen for normal, ordinary people like ourselves, but also we can do this tonglen towards practitioners who are already at a higher level of the path, striving for nirvana or enlightenment, and we can take their mental afflictions, or in the case of the high-level bodhisattva, we can take out take in these subtle stains from them, these cognitive obscurations, which I think are mentioned here in the text. So I just wanted to sort of clarify that. And then there was light.
See?
See? All good.
After the 3 days.
That's it. So just to summarize then the meditative practice of Tonglen, I'd like to read from this book again here, The Practice of Lojong. And what he says about this Tonglen practice. So this is on page 65. Tonglen is the contemplative practice of relative bodhicitta. So he calls here conventional bodhicitta relative bodhicitta. This practice is counterintuitive to the way we normally understand our experiences, which is to reject everything we don't want and cling to everything we do want. We undertake Tonglen because our physical actions are a direct result of our mental habits. Unless we transform these negative mental habits, we'll never be able to manifest compassion, either in our actions or in our thoughts. In Tonglen, we are trying to adopt a radically new way of looking at things. Tonglen is called exchanging oneself for others because it involves giving away everything that is good in our lives and taking on everything that is bad in the lives of others. It is a training in courage because the whole point of doing it is to train ourselves to be less fearful and anxious. Our capacity to feel love and compassion for others and our courage to take on their suffering will increase if our Tonglen practice is working. This practice is so extremely beneficial because we're training ourselves to stop thinking about everything from a defensive posture. The more selfish and egocentric we are, the more defensive we become. If we think about sharing our happiness, we'll become less self-obsessed and our conflicting emotions will naturally subside. Self-obsession is not just about over-evaluating our own worth. It also includes our feelings of inadequacy and self-criticism. Contrary to our fears, mentally taking on the sufferings of others does not compound our pain. It enriches our lives, releases us from the nagging problems that normally plague us, and has a transformative effect on our psyche. Whereas self-obsession diminishes our being and keeps us trapped in inner turmoil, Tonglen, an antidote to all forms of self-obsession, enables our mind to become elevated and expansive. And then there's a little bit more on page 68 at the end. He says, people new to Tonglen have many trepidations and doubts. Some people think, if I do Tonglen, I'll be totally miserable because I'll always be thinking about the suffering of others. Others think that when things go wrong, it's a direct result of Tonglen practice. Both these fears are completely misplaced. It is impossible to invite misfortune and disruption into our lives through Tonglen. We have to remind ourselves that we do not engage in the practice of sending and taking in order to share the suffering of others. For example, if someone is suffering from cancer and we take on his or her suffering in Tonglen practice, we should not think, now I will get cancer. Once we have visualized taking on others' suffering, it immediately dissipates within us. Other people think they just don't have a lot of love to give. I often hear people say, I feel so empty, it's like I have nothing inside. This is a common experience for most of us because we have been self-obsessed since the day we were born. If we have siblings, we may remember that when we were children, we not only wanted to eat our share of the food, but theirs as well. We wanted our sister or brother's toys, and if we did not get them, we threw a tantrum. The emptiness we feel is a lack of love and compassion for others. If we have those wholesome emotions, we would not experience this existential crisis of nothingness. We feel nurtured when we are nurturing. Only a nurturing person can nurture, and a nurturing person is nurtured by his or her caring attitudes. If you can develop these qualities, you will no longer have to go around like a sponge, soaking up the drops of love others leave behind. Buddhas have gone beyond suffering, so how can they share in the suffering of others? There is no such thing as a Buddha that suffers with us or shares in our suffering. Having been human beings, they know what it means to suffer, which is why their compassion is endless and infinite. It is not because Buddhas are enlightened that they know about suffering, even though they no longer experience suffering. Their transcendence of suffering is the key point in Buddhism. Suffering is the combination of pain and attempting to avoid that pain. Once we rid ourselves of grasping and avoidance, we are only left with our pain, which is not the same as suffering. If you are still suffering after attaining enlightenment, all mind training and arduous spiritual practice would have been for nothing. Nothing is literally given away and nothing is literally being taken on when we do Tong Lan. When we breathe in, we are not afraid to take on the illness, grief, distress, physical ailments or mental torment of others. When we breathe out, we are not afraid to send out loving thoughts and caring attitudes to others, or to imagine that we are strong enough to be of help to them. Some people assume that Tong Len can't possibly have an impact on anyone else's life because it is only a mental exercise. From a Buddhist point of view, the interconnected nature of everything suggests that there will be some impact on others. Just as our selfish and neediness has an adverse impact on others, our positive attitudes will also impact on others in a tangible way. Lojong practice is ultimately for oneself. However, it is not a method for solving the world's problems. Even if we diligently breathe out affirmations with the wish to solve the world's problems, these will not have no actual effect on the world. However, breathing out our wonderful virtues and breathing in terrible sufferings will have an actual and very powerful effect on our own transformation. All the difficulties and painful experiences that we have in life come about from our fixation on the notion of self and others. When we exchange ourselves for others, we experience self-transcendence because we have gone beyond the parameters of our own egotistic mind. We experience a release from the imprisonment of our own conventional egoism and become something greater than ourselves. If we have the Lojong attitude, many of the problems that once seemed so overwhelming will cease to matter. When we are grateful to other people for providing us the opportunity to develop these transformative abilities, we realize that we are the real beneficiaries of Tong Len practice. Any questions about Tong Len? Because now I'd like to go on to the next section, which talks about how to now integrate this into our daily life. Okay, so let's move on in the text. So page 6, halfway down on the left, the subsequent period practices. So this is the exchanging self with others in daily life. So here we have a slogan. The first slogan says, there are three objects, three poisons, and three roots of virtue. So the three objects are attractive, unattractive, and neutral objects. And then here when it talks about three poisons is then generally how we react to these three objects. And of course, with attractive objects, we generally often develop attachment. The unattractive objects, of course, aversion. And for the neutral objects, we simply reinforce our false belief that they are existing independent of us, which, of course, is ignorance. And then we'll look at the three roots of virtue shortly. So it says, in the subsequent periods, train the mind by purifying the fields of your experience. When in relation to form, sounds, and so on that are either attractive, unattractive, or neutral, you experience emotions such as attachment, anger, and delusion. So here, delusion is another word for ignorance. And anger, of course, is a very strong type of aversion. So often when we see these three poisons listed, and of course they're often listed as the three core mental afflictions, sometimes instead of aversion, you'll see anger mentioned, as it is here, because anger is a very strong type of aversion that's very destructive. And sometimes instead of ignorance, you'll see here the word delusion, or also sometimes confusion. It says, train the mind in the following manner. So now we have a practice of this exchanging self with others, of how to help us to, as it says here, to purify our field of experience. Meaning instead of reacting to attractive, unattractive, neutral objects in this way, we can cultivate these three roots of virtue, which we're going to look at shortly. So what I'd like to do before we look at how what we do is to really clarify these three poisons, just to have them very clear in our mind. So ignorance, of course, we've looked at in some detail in the Vipassana practice, the wisdom side of the practice. So the word ignorance is coming from a Sanskrit word. Avidya, which literally means not knowing, not understanding. Ah is a sort of negation. Vidya means to know. And sometimes here, instead of avidya, and what's usually translated as confusion, is a very similar word, moha. Similar meaning, not knowing, not understanding, confusion. And of course here, in the three poisons, this ignorance, I mean, ignorance in general is simply a deluded state of mind that is confused about its object. So we can have many types of ignorance. We can be confused about many things. But here in the three poisons, this ignorance is a very specific ignorance. It's an ignorance, misunderstanding, nature of reality. And what we saw here earlier was that following the Majjhimika philosophical system in Buddhism, this ignorance is this grasping onto independent me, independent world. And we saw how that grasping onto independent me and independent world led to attachment and aversion, to the other mental afflictions, to our behaviour, and then all of our suffering. So we've had a look at ignorance in quite some detail. So what I'd like to do now is focus on the other two poisons, have them clear in our mind. And like the text here, when we talk about aversion, I want to focus on anger. So let's define first aversion or anger and attachment. And attachment in Sanskrit is raga. And attachment is defined as, well, let's go back to ignorance. Ignorance is defined as a mental factor that is confused about its object. So ignorance is a mental factor that is confused about its object. So that's general ignorance. Of course, here, the very specific type of ignorance is that it's confused about how things exist. It grasps onto them as existing independently. So here, ignorance, again, is not simply not knowing, it's a misunderstanding. It's an active misunderstanding. And it's a grasping onto things existing inherently or independently. So attachment. Attachment is a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. So it's a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness. So it sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So it's a mental factor that sees its object as attractive. It exaggerates the object's attractiveness and then wishes to possess and hold the object. Why? Because it believes that's the source of our happiness. Anger is sort of the flip side of that. Anger is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as unattractive. It exaggerates the object's unattractiveness and then wishes to harm the object. So again, anger is a mental factor that sees its object as unattractive. It exaggerates the object's unattractiveness and then wishes to harm the object. Why? Because anger believes that object is the source of our suffering. So what we see in attachment and anger, what's common, is this factor of exaggeration or distortion. And that is in general across all mental afflictions. That mental afflictions exaggerate or distort. They do not see reality, its respective object, in a clear way. Now I'd like to look at these two, attachment and anger, and try and dispel some misconceptions about them. Because often they're not understood very well. First, let's look at anger. Now, in general, most of us appreciate that anger is very destructive and we really need to overcome anger. It's quite harmful. In general, that's the case, I think. But even still, sometimes people say, but sometimes I need anger. Sometimes anger is useful to work through difficult situations. If I didn't have anger, I wouldn't be able to deal with these difficult situations. Of course, it's true that anger is very powerful. No doubt about that. But anger distorts. It exaggerates. So what often happens, of course, is that if we resort to anger in a difficult situation, because of this distortion and exaggeration, we often overreact. And when we overreact, often the situation gets worse, it gets out of control. So the Buddhist answer to that is, we don't need anger. In fact, anger is harmful, so the antidote is patience. And then when people hear that, they also generate a misconception. Because when they hear that Buddhism says to practice patience, then often people think, okay, what I need to do is just sit there and do nothing. That's not patience. Patience is not a behavior, at least how it's defined in Buddhism. Patience is a mental attitude. Patience is simply defined as an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So patience is an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So if we're faced with a difficult situation and we have patience, i.e., we can stay calm then we have a better chance of more accurately evaluating the situation and seeing the situation more clearly, rather than if we allow anger to arise and anger distorts and exaggerates. With patience, we can more clearly see what the actual situation is and have a better chance of responding in a more constructive way. So what is the forceful, what is the strong force that we would need to use then when we're faced with a difficult situation if we are not to use anger? And that strong force, of course, is compassion. Now, often people feel and think that anger is a sign of strength and compassion is a sign of weakness. Actually, it's the exact opposite. Anger is a sign of weakness because we're not able to deal with the situation without resorting to anger. So that's a sign of weakness. And compassion is a sign of strength. Because with compassion, we can be very forceful. Because remember, compassion is not about sitting there smiling and saying nice things. Compassion is about, if someone else is behaving in a bad way, compassion is about helping that person to overcome that negative behavior. So if someone is behaving in a very harmful way, then with compassion, we can use physical force to restrain that person if necessary. So compassion can be very forceful. And of course, it's looking for out for the welfare of others. So actually, compassion is a sign of strength. And here, I think, and this was really highlighted to me recently, where I actually read a book, or part of a book, written by a psychologist who was basically saying that these Buddhist people, they got it all wrong about anger. And he was saying, you know, Buddhism says get rid of anger altogether. He said that's not a good thing. That's wrong. He said what we need to do is have the right amount of anger in the right situation in the right time. And when I read further, it became obvious and clear to me that how he was using the word anger was very different to how the word is used in Buddhism. And I think he didn't appreciate that fact. Because here, in the definition of anger, there is an intention to harm. So when we use the word anger in Buddhism, there's always an intention to harm, to hurt. That we need to get rid of 100%. I think what's often used in psychology to refer as anger is often if we are using very forceful language or behavior to get across to a person some message. For example, the classic is if a young child runs across the road without watching, looking for the traffic, then you know, the mother's not going to go, "Oh, Johnny, please don't do that. That's dangerous." I mean, the child's probably not going to listen. But if she uses very strong language to get through to the child that it's dangerous, then someone else goes, "Wow, she's really angry at him." But generally, I think she has a strong compassion for the child and understands we need to use very strong language to get across to the child that it's dangerous to cross the road. So in Buddhism, of course, if the mother has intention to harm, that's anger, but generally she doesn't. She just wants to really help her child to not do dangerous things. So from a Buddhist perspective, that wouldn't be anger at all. That would be sometimes called wrathful compassion. It's strong compassion. So I think this is what I understood from this book was that, because he was saying that, you know, if you Buddhists, if you give up anger altogether, how are you going to deal with social injustice, for example? And of course, the Buddhist answer would be using strong compassion, wrathful compassion. We can use very forceful words and behavior to help change negative behavior. So it was clear to me that what he was using as anger and what Buddhism terms as anger is not the same thing. So here again, when we see the word anger in Buddhism, there's always this intention to harm. And then I'd like to go back and touch on a point that I briefly touched on, I think, a couple of times, that I think can be very helpful. And to talk about this again, we can ask a question relevant to what we're doing here, is when we do this Tonglen practice, you know, we start with friends and strangers and so forth, and then we go out to people who we find difficult, and we're trying to do this Tonglen, taking their suffering, giving them happiness. Often people find that very difficult, even to the point where often they go, that person doesn't really deserve it. They don't deserve it. And then similarly, related to that, is why is it that we get angry with people who behave badly? And there's a very simple answer. Why do we get angry with people who behave badly, and why is it so difficult to have forgiveness and compassion for them? Very easy answer. If someone is behaving badly, the correct perspective would be to simply see there's a person who's doing or engaging in a bad or harmful behavior. So that's the correct perspective, just to see that. But very often, when we have this situation, we often don't adopt this perspective. Often we adopt the perspective there's a bad person, there's a nasty person. So what we've done here is we have fused the person to the behaviour. We have fused them together, made them one thing. In psychology, this is called cognitive fusion. And it's an invalid or false perspective, because there are two things here. There's a person and their behaviour. And so when we stick them together, we fuse them together and make them one thing, then we're in trouble. Because in any given situation, we've got two choices: accept or reject. And generally, if someone's behaving badly, we reject. But if we do cognitive fusion, reject translates into attacking the person. Because the thing we don't like is their behaviour. But because we fuse the behaviour to the person, we end up attacking the person. Which, of course, is not very helpful. But then, if we understand attacking the person is not the right thing to do, then the only other option left is accept. But if we do cognitive fusion and we accept, we end up accepting their bad behaviour. Of course, this is not helpful either. And then, when it comes to forgiveness and compassion, it becomes almost impossible. Because to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. But that's what it feels like when we try to do forgiveness or compassion. It feels like somehow we are accepting or it's okay for them to behave in that way. And of course it's not. And also, of course, if we see them as a bad person, we end up with a fixed, biased view of them. Because everyone sometimes does good things, sometimes does not so good things. But if we label them, if we fuse their behaviour to the person and see them as a bad thing, a bad person rather, then it becomes very difficult to acknowledge any good qualities that they have or any good things that they do, because bad people don't do good things. So if they happen to do something good, we go, no, they didn't really mean it. They're a bad person. So we have a fixed, biased view of the person. And we can't see or acknowledge any of their good qualities. So, of course, the simple solution to this is don't do cognitive fusion, because it's an invalid, false perspective. You simply have the correct perspective and acknowledge there is a person who is engaging in a harmful behaviour. And then we can accept the person, i.e. have forgiveness or compassion for the person. And at the same time not accept or tolerate their negative behaviour and address their negative behaviour. And to help that, and have compassion and help that person to overcome that negative behaviour. And then, of course, we can have a balanced view of the person. And also here, doing cognitive fusion promotes differences. Because I'm okay, but that's a bad person. So it's me and them. Bad people, good people. So it promotes differences. And therefore causes division and makes communication more difficult. Whereas if we don't do cognitive fusion, then we are all people wanting to be happy. We all sometimes do bad behaviour and sometimes do good behaviour. So we're all similar. So if we have correct perspective, that promotes similarity and communication. Any questions about this? We also do this with ourselves. And this is often why, and this is why, in fact, there's an epidemic of low self-esteem and self-hatred and guilt in our modern society. Because we always do this, or generally. We focus on the negative, and if we've done something negative, we usually don't have the correct perspective and simply acknowledge, I have done something harmful. Rather, I'm a bad person. And so, of course, if we do cognitive fusion with respect to ourselves, and we often do that, I'm a bad person, I'm a hopeless person, I'm a nasty person, I'm useless, I'm this, I'm this, I'm this, then, of course, what we don't like, of course, we don't like our bad behaviour, but since we do cognitive fusion, what do? We attack ourselves. We attack ourselves, we say we're no good, end up with low self-esteem and self-hatred. And then when it comes to forgiveness and compassion, I don't deserve it because I'm just a bad person. That's me. So we end up again with a fixed, biased view of ourselves and we're stuck. So to overcome that, of course, to overcome low self-esteem, self-hatred and guilt is simply stop doing cognitive fusion. Because it's an invalid, false perspective. Simply acknowledge, I have done a harmful behaviour. And then instead of feeling guilty and having low self-esteem and self-hatred, we can have compassion for ourselves, forgiveness for ourselves, and address our negative behaviour. Regret that negative behaviour and look at ways of overcoming it. And then we can still have good self-esteem and compassion for ourselves. So if we are suffering from low self-esteem, guilt or self-hatred, I can almost guarantee this is what we're doing. Any questions? There's one more thing I wanted to add, but maybe if there's questions first.
So then should we also not do that with positive actions?
Exactly what I was going to say. Good point. Of course, in our modern society, we tend to always focus on the negative. And if we do that with respect to ourselves or others, we end up in a big mess, as we can see. But also, doing it for positive things is not helpful. And unfortunately, this is often presented as the method to overcome low self-esteem. And it doesn't work. You know, if a child is not feeling so good, you know, the parents or so, that they'll go, no, no, Johnny, you're special. You're special. You're special. Disaster. Absolute disaster. Because two things will happen. One is, oh, I'm special. In fact, I'm better than everyone else. So it's going to boost the ego and it's going to lead to self-cherishing. So this is not good. And then, of course, when that child sees that they can't live up to the label of being special, then they plummet even further the other direction. So it's not helpful to do it on the positive either. So therefore, if someone is behaving in a good way, then don't praise the person, because it's just going to lead to a big head ego trip. Rather, have a correct perspective and praise their behavior. So if someone's behaving well, praise their behavior, because that'll encourage them to continue to engage in that behavior. If you praise the person, they're probably just going to get a big head thinking they're special, they're better than everyone else. Same with ourselves. If we do a good action, don't praise ourselves. Praise the behavior. Rejoice in our behavior. And that'll encourage us to continue to engage in that positive behaviour in the future. So whether we're talking on the negative or positive, if we do cognitive fusion, we often end up in difficulties, into problems.
It's like the culture of princesses and princes.
Sorry?
Like you have the culture today with the kids. Oh, you're my little princess, you're my little prince. And all of the parents are like, my little princess. And even some of the kindergarten teachers are like, all the prince and the princess of the kindergarten.
Yeah, of course, if the teacher says that, then the child goes, I'm the teacher's pet. I'm better than all you other kids. You know, it's a disaster.
Can you imagine a whole kindergarten thinking like that?
And that's unfortunately what often happens. And mm-hmm. So that's why there's fighting.
Yeah, my God.
Fighting. I'm better than you. No, I'm better than you. Disaster. <Okay. laughs> Disaster.
Usually this cognitive fusion, it is enough to just get rid of this low self-esteem and blaming yourself for not being good enough.
Yeah. Because you can only have low self-esteem if you identify with your negative thoughts, emotions and behavior and habits. If you don't identify with them, how are you going to have low self-esteem? No matter how much negative behavior you have, if you don't identify with it, you can still feel good about yourself.
And this identification is just a habit.
It's a habit.
It's a wrong habit.
It's a wrong habit, and unfortunately, this way of speaking has been drilled into our head since we were this high. You know, how often do we see that when a very young child is misbehaving, the parent goes, bad girl, bad boy. I mean, disaster. It's a disaster.
This feeling of guilt, it's very, very innate, like...
Exactly. And what I've read is that there's one person did some research on it, and it seems like guilt was invented centuries ago as a way of having power over people. Mm-hmm. Make them feel bad. Give them the guilt trip. Then we can have control over them. We can control them if we make them feel bad.
Isn't it Christian religion? I mean, not that
I think it's not just Christians.
Not the teaching of Jesus Christ was made out of it.
Huh?
Sorry? In Israel, you would call it Polish mothers.
Yeah.
You would call it Polish mothers.
Do the guilt trip. Polish mothers.
This is like a French. It's because, like, Polish mother is always like, oh, don't worry about me. I will stay here alone in the house. Go, do your things. It's like the always guilt tripping that you get from parents.
Making you feel guilty.
It's a goodbye.
Because you didn't
care for me. I
do. Okay. Any questions about this? Otherwise, I'll move on to talk about attachment now. Okay. So generally, when it comes to anger, most people appreciate that anger is harmful. Let's overcome it. But when it comes to attachment, often it's a very different story. And often people feel as if they get rid of attachment, their life is going to be very boring. Because I need attachment to enjoy life. Actually, it's completely opposite. The more we get rid of attachment, the more we will enjoy the simple pleasures in life. Because if we have strong craving and attachment to the sense pleasures, that really agitates the mind. And then, of course, if we don't get them, we get frustrated. Even if we get them, they never really satisfy us. We simply end up craving more, 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 more. And as I think I earlier mentioned, attachment is always looking for something bigger, better, and different. Which means even the things we sort of used to enjoy, attachment now, if we get them too often, attachment will say at some point, sorry, that's not good enough anymore. I need something bigger, better, and different. So actually, attachment destroys our enjoyment of simple pleasures in life. If we can reduce and eliminate attachment, we will enjoy the simple pleasures in life much, much more than we have ever done before. But then people go, okay, maybe that might be true, but I definitely need attachment in a relationship. If I don't have attachment, there's no way I could have a relationship. So again, it's a complete misunderstanding. And sometimes this comes from the word attachment itself. Because again, here, how the word attachment is used in psychology is different. Because in psychology, we talk about attachment theory. And we talk about actually needing to actively develop healthy forms of attachment. We have to develop healthy forms of attachment. And one of the examples often given is the strong bond between mother and child. From a Buddhist perspective, not only do we need a strong bond between mother and child, we need a strong bond between everyone, ourselves and everyone. So having a strong bond is not attachment. But that's how often the word attachment is used in psychology. In fact, I've got a couple of definitions of the word attachment from psychology here. One definition of attachment in psychology is that attachment is an enduring emotional tie to a special person characterized by a tendency to seek and maintain closeness, especially during times of stress. Another definition of attachment in psychology, a feeling that binds one to a person, thing, cause, or the like. And another definition is, attachment is a feeling of affection for a person. And some synonyms for attachment in psychology, affection, devotion, regard, loyalty, love. So this is very different how the word attachment is used in Buddhism. So remember, attachment in Buddhism is attachment sees its object as attractive, it exaggerates the object's attractiveness, and then wishes to possess and hold the object. So in a relationship, there's usually two things mixed. There is love or loving kindness and attachment. And they're usually mixed. So therefore, we need to understand one of those is healthy, one is unhealthy. Loving kindness is healthy, attachment is very unhealthy for a relationship. And to distinguish them, love or loving kindness in a relationship is the wish for that other person to be happy. And the fine print, of course, is without expecting anything in return. What we would call unconditional love, no strings attached love. Strings attached love or conditional love is love polluted by attachment. And that sounds like this. I will love you as long as, here comes the condition, I will love you as long as you keep saying and doing things that make me happy. Otherwise, no. So very simply, the difference between love and loving kindness and attachment is love or loving kindness is saying, I want you to be happy. Attachment is saying, I want you to make me happy. So attachment's all about me, 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 me. And actually attachment sees the other person as an object, a thing to gratify me. So it dehumanizes attachment. It sees the person as an object. So if we want our relationships to improve, we need to identify these two dynamics, increase the loving kindness part and decrease the attachment part. Now, what we need to remember, of course, is that attachment is pervasive in our life. In Buddhism, we often say that we live in the desire realm. And the word desire there is another word for attachment. And there is a 4th century text, which I read, which said, it's called the desire realm because there are two driving desires in the human realm. What do you think the two main desires or attachments in the human realm are? The two main attack drives desires.
Sex.
Huh?
Sex and money.
Sex and food.
Food and sex. Food first.
Food first. Food and sex.
And money.
Well, that comes as well. And that's actually what this 4th century text said. In the 4th century, it said that the two main desires are food and sex. I don't think much has changed since the 4th century. So what we need to appreciate is that where our life is pervaded by attachment at many levels. So it would be completely unrealistic to think, okay, by next week I'm going to get rid of my attachment. It's simply not going to happen. It's something that we'll need to work on for the rest of our life. And the more we can get rid of attachment, the more we will enjoy the simple pleasures in life, the more our relationships will improve. And actually, there's the third doubt that often people, when we look at that, they go, okay, I can, maybe that is true, but I'm a creative person and I need attachment to be a creative. Complete misunderstanding again. Of course, mental afflictions like craving, attachment, jealousy and anger are fuel for the creative process. How many songs and pictures have been done based on that? But what is the source of creativity is not mental afflictions. Creativity comes deep within our mind, and as long as our mind is agitated by the mental afflictions, it's suffocating creativity. So if we can reduce and eliminate these mental afflictions, creativity will increase. And now often we tend to be creative for quite a sort of selfish motivation, you know. Look at me, how wonderful an artist or musician I am. Whereas if we eliminate the mental afflictions, not only will we become much more creative, we'll become more creative for a more meaningful reason. We'll use our creative talents to inspire others, to benefit others, rather than as an ego trip. So if we can reduce our attachment, we will enjoy the simple pleasures in life much more than we do now. Our relationships will improve immeasurably and we'll become much more creative for a much more meaningful reason. We'll be able to use our talents to benefit the world and inspire others. So it's win-win-win in terms of reducing and eliminating attachment. Any question about attachment before we go for a tea break?
How to
lessen it. Yeah. So, with all, and we've already looked at that briefly yesterday, if we want to change any habit, we first need mindfulness. Because if we want to be able to catch it before it takes hold of us. So that's another reason why shamatha practice is so helpful, is that if we improve our mindfulness, then we have this little window of opportunity to do something when a mental affliction like attachment, aversion, jealousy is coming up. Then we have a window of opportunity to do something. So what can we do? There are a number of things we can do, particularly with attachment. One, of course, is just observe it, as we saw yesterday. Just watch that craving come up and pass. So that's one approach. Very helpful. In fact, that reminds me of a story. Some years ago, I was in Bodh Gaya, but I was running this introduction to Buddhism course that I usually run here. And one person who came to the course was a Dutch man. He was a corporate lawyer in his 50s, I think, or maybe even early 60s. And he looked awful. He looked literally green. His skin looked green because he was a chain smoker. He'd smoked 60 cigarettes a day for 20 years. And his wife sent him to India to sort himself out. Because not only was he chain smoking, he was a mess. So he came to the introduction course and we talked about this mindfulness and just observing and so forth. And then during the course, he started to do that, observing his cravings. Because we don't crave objects. We crave the sensation that they give us. So we never crave cigarettes or alcohol or whatever. We crave the sensation that they give us. So if we can observe that craving, and that's what he started to do in the course. He started to observe his craving for nicotine, the stimulation it would give.
He was still smoking?
No.
Because,
no, because in the course, you weren't allowed to smoke in the grounds. So it sort of forced him to do that for those days. And then after the course he left, and 3 months later he came here and he looked so much better. And he had not had one cigarette in 3 months. And he had no craving for cigarettes anymore. And that was just by observing the craving. That's all he did. I'm not suggesting if we just do that, we'll be able to easily give up our cravings, but it's possible, you know. So he looked a lot better.
60 cigarettes.
60 a day, and he'd done it for 20 years.
Crazy.
20 years. 60 a day. He was just like... Oh, sorry, I want to finish your answer. So one thing we can do is just observe the craving, the attachment, rise and pass. On top of that, of course, what we've already looked at in the wisdom, the Vipassana practice, is if there is some craving or attachment coming up, it's toward an object. Then look at the object, the person, the food, whatever, and look for the attractiveness in the object. Where is the attractiveness in that piece of cake or that person or that thing? Or we can turn our attention to ourselves. You know, we're starting to get some craving. Where is the me that is craving this? Where is the me that is craving this object? Look for the me. So that's the wisdom approach to overcome attachment. And another one I've mentioned already is impermanence. If we can really reflect on impermanence and really appreciate that everything's changing moment by moment, that is usually given as the antidote to attachment. Because if we can see that that thing or person that we're craving is changing moment by moment, there's nothing to grab. Intellectually we know that, but if we can bring it inside, if we can really experientially see things as changing moment by moment, attachment will dramatically decrease. So that's another approach. And then what we're going to look at now is another approach here. We have the compassion approach, the Tonglen approach to overcoming attachment. So that's the next point we're going to look at in the next session. So we've got a number of approaches we can use. Quick question, and then we'll take a tea break.
I'd like to know when you say self-craving, if you speak about the
physical sensation.
You can you can either observe the mental craving or you can observe at the physical level, whichever you find easier. Because generally each mental, certainly mental afflictions have a corresponding effect in the body. So if you find it easier to observe the sensations in the body, you can do that, that are associated with the craving or the aversion or anger or whatever. You can do either of those two. It's fine.
Or just the mental
factor. Or the mental. You can just observe your mental wanting that, your craving for that object. Just watch that. Or you can observe the sensations in the body associated with it. That also works.
Is it the same with anger? Like,
sure.
If I get angry, I should just observe and
to... Yeah, so with all mental afflictions, we can just use mindfulness. We can use the wisdom approach, the compassion approach, the impermanence approach. We have many approaches to help us. And we use the one that works for us. Okay, let's take a break and then continue on with this at 3:30.